last time we talked about how you could use radioactive or other kind of tagged labeling to follow material into the cell by, for example, receptor-mediated endocytosis. And today I want to talk about how you can follow things out of the cell, and then I want to talk about how things get where they're supposed to go. So, first of all, let's consider, if you do, how you could label newly made proteins. And one way to do that is to supply the cells with radioactive amino acids. And if you do that, they will make radioactive protein. So what you do is you provide radioactive amino acids, and then after various time intervals, you take samples of the cell, and you wash out the unattached amino acids. So the only amino acids that are left in the cell are the ones that were made into protein. So you take your samples at 0, 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, etc., and then you see where is the radioactivity in the cell. You either use autoradiography to identify in the cell layer or slice what compartment has the radioactivity, or you do a fractionation, a grind and find type experiment to separate the parts of the cell into nuclei, ER, Golgi, etc., and then you measure the radioactivity in each fraction. So either way, you measure the amount of radioactivity in each part of the cell. Now what happens if you do that? So if you look at the curves at the top of 6A, we're measuring the amount of radioactivity or other label with time. And this is a continuous label. The amino acids have been around for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever. And now you're looking at the amount of radioactivity in each cell fraction. So the first curve here is the rough ER. The second curve is the Golgi. The third are what are called secretory vesicles, which are just vesicles near the edge of the cell. And the last is outside. Now, what does this look like? The first part of the cell to contain radioactivity, meaning newly made protein, is what? It's the rough ER, is the first part of the cell to get radioactive. But then if you wait a little while, the Golgi becomes radioactive. And the amount of radioactivity in the rough ER plateaus. So that implies that proteins are being made in the rough ER and passed on to the Golgi. And at this point, you're making new protein and passing on new protein. So the amount of label in that compartment stays the same. Now, the Golgi gets more and more radioactivity, but then the Golgi starts passing its newly made protein to the next guy. And so the amount of radioactivity in the Golgi plateaus. The next thing to become more and more radioactive are the vesicles. And finally, radioactivity appears outside the cell. And the amount outside the cell just continues to increase with time. So this looks like radioactive protein, newly made protein, is first in the rough ER, then in the Golgi, then in the vesicles, and then the vesicles release it to the outside. Remember last time we said there are two ways you can do labeling? You can do a continuous label, or you can do a pulse chase. The other curve is a pulse chase. So that means that you provide radioactive amino acids for a short time, then you wash them away, and you add unlabeled amino acids outside the cells. So there is a bolus, like moving down the boa constrictor. There is a little bit of new protein made, but then after that, the new protein that's made is not radioactive. There's only a little bit of radioactive new protein. So this time, what happens? Same axes, label in time, same curves. This is the rough ER, then the Golgi,
and the secretory vesicles, and then outside.
So as expected, the first part of the cell to become radioactive is the rough ER, because that's where the new proteins are. But the newly made radioactive proteins leave the rough ER. It keeps making new proteins, but the new proteins that come in are not radioactive. So the bulge of radioactive proteins leaves, and the rough ER becomes non-radioactive. But now the Golgi becomes radioactive as the protein passes through from the ER to the Golgi to the secretory vesicles until it gets outside. And this time, once everything is outside, no more radioactivity is made, and the amount plateaus outside. So this kind of experiment is often done to follow things. And this, in fact, an experiment like this, was the first one to give people the idea that newly made protein that's supposed to go outside is made on the rough ER, handed off to the Golgi, handed off to a secretory vesicle, and released to the outside. And one of the things we want to discuss today is how that protein is targeted. How does it know where to go, so to speak? But before we leave that, we want to mention one other way of following new protein. And this is something we've talked about many times, which is using GFP, or something equivalent to it. That's green fluorescent protein. It's a tag, basically, that you can see in a living cell. The trick with GFP and all of its relatives is that you have to introduce a new recombinant gene into the cell. So then, if the cell makes a protein from that recombinant gene, first that protein will appear here, then that protein will appear here, then it will go to the vesicles, and then it will go out. But the cell makes its own labeled protein. So the trick is, you have to have a recombinant gene. So you have the DNA of your cell, and here's the gene for the protein that you want to follow around. This is, as they say, the gene for the protein of interest. And then what you do is, by genetic engineering, you introduce a copy of the gene for green fluorescent protein or something similar. This is a very small gene for a very small protein, but the protein, remember, is fluorescent. So depending on the experiment, you can put the green fluorescent protein coding part on this end or on that end. Let's say we put it in here. And now when we look at the DNA again, we now have a gene that codes for the protein, and then it codes for additional amino acids, the amino acids of GFP. So this will be transcribed. This will be translated into a chain of amino acids, and then this will fold up. And usually it folds up something so that the regular part of the protein folds up more or less normally and does its thing. And the little bit of GFP, tail or leader part, folds up and fluoresces, but does not get in the way of interfering with the function of the normal protein. So this protein then goes wherever it's supposed to go in a cell, and it does its usual thing, but it carries a light bulb on its head or its behind, so to speak. And this technology is very, very widely used. You open any journal today of anything remotely related to this issue, to cell biology, and they will be using some variant of it. And that's why Chalfi and his associates won the Nobel Prize in chemistry in 2008 for this discovery, because it's so widely used. It's led to many, many discoveries. You've already met problems and exam questions with this protein, and you will meet more, I guarantee. Okay. So this tells you that you can follow proteins around and see, after they're made, where they go. And if we use this technology extensively, what do we find out? Where do proteins go? And then the question is, how do they, quote unquote, know what their destination is supposed to be? So that's what I want to talk about next. So I want to say, first of all, the short version of what determines where a protein will go. That is built in to the amino acid sequence of the protein. There is some sequence of amino acids somewhere in the protein that says, so to speak, take me to a lysosome, send me to the outside, take me to the nucleus. Now, of course, that's only an analogy. That means that that sequence binds to something which leads to a mechanism which sends the protein where it's supposed to go. So, what these things, these stretches of amino acids, are called localization signals in general. And this localization signal is called a tag, or it's called an address. Depends what you want. And sometimes the sequence of amino acids is in one spot on the protein. Might be in the middle, might be on the end, but there's a contiguous sequence of amino acids. And if the protein has that, it goes somewhere. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And that's usually called a localization signal. Or an LS. Or a localization peptide or something like that. Now, on the bottom of 7A is a list, a little table, with some of the most famous localization signals. That's largely for reference. We're not going to do all of those today. That's just to give you some idea and to have for reference what's possible. For example, many proteins have a short section right on their amino end, which directs them to the rough ER. And that's called a signal peptide, or an SP. And we will meet many other signals of this kind. Some proteins, however, do not have a signal consisting of contiguous amino acids. Instead, it's made of a couple amino acids here, and a couple there, and one there. However, when the protein folds up in three dimensions, all of those are next to each other on the chain. So that on the surface of the protein folded in three dimensions, there is a little patch, and that this can be recognized by the appropriate receptor. And I think the M6P receptor recognizes a patch. We'll explain what this is later. This is important directing proteins to lysosomes. And some nuclear localization signals are like this. The take me to a nucleus signal is sometimes a patch, as this is called. Or a localization patch. Now, some proteins have multiple localization signals or patches. For example, something that's supposed to go into the mitochondrion, into the inner membrane, will have multiple signals, one of which says, take me to a mitochondrion, and then the second one, which is usually read after the first one, says, of all the parts of the mitochondrion, because there's the matrix, the inner membrane, the outer membrane, etc., take me to the inner membrane. So there can be more than one signal. So now what we want to do is look at the top of 7A. We want to consider, where do proteins go? What are the basic choices? What kinds of basic signals do we need, or localization signals, to get everybody to the right place? And then we'll come back later and look at some individual signals. So first, let's look at the big picture, which is 7A. Said that where a protein goes is built in to the sequence of the protein itself. So in order to know where a protein goes, you have to make it first. So in fact, what usually happens is the cell starts making the protein without knowing where it is supposed to go. So a ribosome is attached to a message, and it starts making protein. Now, if that protein has in its sequence the right signal, then that ribosome will attach to the ER. And if the signal is missing, the ribosome and the message will stay in the cytoplasm and will not attach to anything.
So we'll just write free in cytoplasm. And this is what you might call the big divide.
Because anything that attaches to the ER is going to end up as part of the endomembrane system or outside the cell. Anything that is made free in the cytoplasm is going to go somewhere else. And these are the two, this is the big divide number one. And we'll come back and explain what exact, how you do this. But let's just say now, if you have the right signal, which is called the signal peptide that we mentioned over there, if you have a signal peptide, the ribosome attaches to the ER. No signal peptide, you don't. So in this case, let's do the right hand first. If there's no signal peptide, then the ribosome continues to churn out the peptide. It keeps on synthesizing, and you end up releasing the protein into the cytoplasm. Now, when we say free ribosomes, of course, the ribosomes are attached to messenger RNA, but the combination is not attached to a membrane. Now, you might say that this is the default thing to do. In the absence of a signal, this is what happens. But now, once this protein is made, where does it go? It has a choice, depending on what it is. It will end up in some part of the cell that is not part of the endomembrane system. Now, the rock bottom default position, if there are no signals whatsoever, doesn't say anything. It just stays in the cytoplasm. If there is the appropriate signal, then the protein will be imported into the appropriate organelle. And so, what are they? Now, notice it means the protein is made first, and then after it's finished, it gets into an organelle. That means either it remains unfolded and wiggles in through a pore, or somehow it is transported folded. But it's already been made. So this is called post-translational import. By contrast, at least in higher organisms, most proteins that enter the ER do so as they are made. But the proteins that enter the other organelles do it afterwards. So one possibility is into mitochondria. If it's an animal cell or a plant cell, but if it's a plant cell, there's also the issue of chloroplasts. Most of the proteins, as we said before, of mitochondria and chloroplasts are made outside in the cytoplasm and imported into the organelle. Only a few proteins are made inside the organelle itself. But there are other parts of the cell that have to get protein, for example, nuclei. And then there are other organelles, and the only one we're going to talk about that's not part of the endomembrane system is peroxisomes. Lysosomes, the Golgi, etc., is all part of the endomembrane system. We'll get back to that. So depending on a patch or a PEP sequence within the peptide, the protein is sent to the appropriate place. Now, we're not going to go into what the exact sequences are. We'll explain sort of how you know, but we're not going to go into it. If you take cell biology, you'll go more into exactly what are the sequences specifying each of these and more detail about how it's read. But we will come back later and talk a little bit more about how these signals are read. The interesting thing, though, is that none of this is part of the endomembrane system. And to get where you're supposed to go, the protein has to cross at least one membrane. Peroxisomes are surrounded by a single membrane. You have to cross that. Mitochondria, you have to cross two to get into the matrix. And nuclei, you have to cross the envelope. Turns out nuclei have pores, remember, and the transport is through the pores, but the net effect is to get across two membranes. Okay. So now I want to talk about the left-hand site, unless there are questions about this half. Okay, so what about the other half? If the protein, when it starts being made, has the right sequence called a signal peptide, then what will happen is that the ribosome making that protein will become attached to the ER, exactly how we'll explain in a few minutes. Now, what happens then? Since the ribosome is right next to the ER, as the protein is made, it wiggles into the ER. And one of two things can happen. So I've just written here protein in an ER. And this is co-translational import. The protein is imported as it is made. It turns out that in yeast and some simple organisms, even the proteins in the ER are sometimes made first and stuffed in afterwards. In higher organisms, it appears that what belongs in the endomembrane system goes in as it's made. Now, what do we mean by protein in the ER? Remember, the ER is a series of tubes and vesicles. So if this is a cross-section, this is a bilayer, this is the lumen inside, and another bilayer. Remember, this is a cross-section of a tube. Now, where is the protein in the ER? One possibility is that the protein is here in the lumen. The protein has gone all the way in as it was made and is residing inside. So we wrote over here in lumen. Another possibility is that the protein has only gone partway in and is stuck in the membrane and is a transmembrane protein. So it could be that the protein looks more like something like that. That would be a single pass. A multi-pass would look like that. So that the protein is actually a transmembrane protein. So we wrote in ER membrane. What happens next? Some proteins are thought to reside in the ER. That's where they do their thing. Now, those proteins either just stay here, or what is more likely, they're passed on a little further to finish up with some fine point modifications, and then they're shipped back. But it's possible that some proteins stop at this point and stay where they're supposed to be. But most proteins move on. One of the reasons is that proteins usually have to be modified. You have to trim a few amino acids off, you have to add a few sugars, you have to make some disulfide bonds. That kind of stuff only takes place inside the lumen of the ER or the Golgi. So you have to pass it on. So the next step, as we know, in fact, from this experiment, at least for things that are going to leave the cell, they go from the rough ER to the Golgi. And in fact, almost everything that's part of the endomembrane system is passed from the ER to the Golgi. So the next step here is the Golgi. So both of these are likely to get to the Golgi. Now, how are they going to do that? They do that in vesicles that bud off from the Golgi. So a vesicle is going to bud off. And then it's going to fuse with some part of the Golgi. Now, what can you deliver by a vesicle? If something is in the lumen, it can get trapped inside the vesicle and passed along. If something's in the membrane, then a patch of membrane of the vesicle carries it. So this vesicle is both carrying patches of membrane, lipid and protein, and soluble contents, both of which are going to be delivered to the Golgi, because it's going to fuse with some part of the Golgi by the reverse of this budding process. Now, to be sure everybody has got this one, I have a question for you. Suppose, let's blow it up a little bit. You have a transmembrane multipass protein in the ER. Something like this.
So this protein has two domains in the lumen, and actually three domains in the cytoplasm. The amino, the carboxylase, and something in the middle. So let's consider one of its domains that's inside the lumen. When this forms a vesicle, where will X be? And when this fuses with the Golgi, where will X be? Is domain X going to be inside the vesicle or in the cytoplasm? And here's a Golgi sac. When these two fuse, where is X going to end up? Inside the Golgi or in the cytoplasm? So what I want you to do is to sit, draw it, and be sure, see if you and your whoever's around you can come to agreement of where X will be and how this works. Where is X in the vesicle? Where is X in the Golgi? Head. Take a piece of paper and draw it. When we get to the vesicle stage, is how many people think X will be out here in the cytoplasm? X in the lumen. Agreed. What about when you get to here? Will X be in the outside or in the lumen? Well, everybody agrees that X is going to be in the lumen no matter what you do. And that's right. And one way of keeping this straight is what happens in the cytoplasm stays in the cytoplasm. The reason that I'm saying it that way is eventually this thing is going to make a vesicle which is going to fuse with the plasma membrane so that X, if it gets to the plasma membrane, is going to be where? On the outside of the cell or the inside of the cell?
Outside.
It's actually going to be outside of the cell, but that used to be the inside of the vesicle. Confusion reigns. However, if you think about the cytoplasmic part, what starts in the cytoplasm stays in the cytoplasm. And that's probably easier to remember. All right. So let's assume you can do this. If you have any questions and you didn't want to admit it, you can ask me afterwards. Or you could ask someone who claims to know. So now let's go back to our picture and assume that the vesicle reaches the Golgi. So what's going to happen in the Golgi? The Golgi, you remember, is a series of flattened sacs. Sometimes it's compared to pita, a pile of pitas, the Mediterranean kind with a hole in it. And sometimes it's compared to something like this. So this is a sac of membrane with a lumen inside. So what happens is that the vesicle will fuse with one compartment of the Golgi, one sac, and it will then be passed from sac to sac. Exactly how this happens is still under dispute, and we'll talk about it next time. We might get to the structure today, but I don't think so. But we'll talk about how you move the stuff along the Golgi later. But the important part is that vesicles fuse with the Golgi, delivering stuff inside to the lumen, and then other vesicles fuse off, bud off the other side of the Golgi. Again, what was in the lumen is in the lumen, and what happens in the cytoplasm stays in the cytoplasm. So if you go back to our handout here, the things leave the Golgi for multiple destinations. And one of the explanations here is that at the far side of the Golgi, which is called the trans side, at the far side of the Golgi, things basically get sorted, somewhat like in endosomes, in that different kinds of vesicles bud off the Golgi, carrying proteins destined for different places. And so what happens, just to say it quickly, modifications happen in the ER, modifications happen in the Golgi, and then the Golgi sorts. So when things come out of the Golgi, they're vesicles, but they have different destinations. So we have four different ones here on the bottom. The first one is one we've already heard about. We've heard about secretory vesicles. In a cell that makes large amounts of protein to be secreted in response to a signal, such as, for example, the cells that make insulin and many other hormones, or that make digestive enzymes, these cells have vesicles which contain large amounts of the protein that they're going to secrete. But these vesicles wait in the cytoplasm until the cell gets a signal. At the appropriate signal, the vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, you get exocytosis, and the protein's released. So these are called secretory vesicles. And they sit around waiting to fuse with the plasma membrane. So maybe we should draw it. Here's the plasma membrane. Here are the secretory vesicles with stuff inside. When the signal comes, the vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, and the material is released by exocytosis. So as we've written here, signal. And when a vesicle fuses, notice that in addition to releasing its contents from the lumen, whatever material it was made out of, whatever lipids and proteins were in the membrane, fuse with the plasma membrane. Now, this is what was going on in the cells that were studied that we talked about above. The signal was present, and as a result, the secretory vesicles released their material to the outside. Now, I just want to say one thing, that the signals to do it are various. They can be changes in ion concentration, they can be hormones, other hormones, that tell the cell to release its secretory vesicles. But almost always, the signal, whatever it is, leads to an elevation in calcium in the cell. And that an elevation in calcium triggers exocytosis. So if vesicles are lying around, normally in a cell, the calcium is very low. But if the calcium is temporarily raised, exocytosis occurs. And you'll meet many cases of that. Now, this is also called regulated secretion, because the protein is only released in response to the right regulatory signals. But there's also unregulated secretion, or constitutive secretion, or whatever you want to call it. Some people call the vesicles that form in that case default vesicles. And that's the thing I wrote here furthest over, where it says default vesicle. It seems likely that something which has a signal to enter the ER and no other signal ends up in a default vesicle. Once you're in the ER, if you have no further instructions, you're passed on to the Golgi, put into a vesicle, and the vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane. And that's how material is delivered to the plasma membrane, and also to some extent to the extracellular matrix. So secretory vesicles and default vesicles do much the same thing, but one does it automatically, and the other requires some sort of push. Now, there are two other destinations from the Golgi that we've mentioned here. There are probably others, but there are two other ones we mentioned here because they're important to us. One is lysosomes. Some of the vesicles which bud off the Golgi are going to become lysosomes. That means they contain the specific collection of hydrolases with acid pH optima, the special degradation enzymes that belong in a lysosome. They're made, packaged into a particular vesicle, which will eventually turn into or join a pre-existing lysosome and will become much more acidic, allowing the enzymes to work. This vesicle will also have to fuse with another vesicle containing substrate to be degraded. This vesicle contains the enzymes, but not the substrate they work on. And when the enzymes are made, they're not active because the inside of the vesicle isn't acid enough. So these vesicles can be secretory vesicles, they can give rise to lysosomes, or they can be default vesicles. And you notice we have a fourth here, which is the escape clause or the garbage category, that also vesicles can go to other parts of the EMS, of the endomembrane system. Remember we said that there are some proteins whose job is to work inside the ER. It is possible, at least for some of them, in fact we know it's true, that the protein is made in, and put into the ER, sent to the Golgi to be properly processed, but then put into a vesicle and the vesicle goes back to the ER and fuses with the ER, delivering the finished goods. So some of the stuff that's found in the ER or the earlier parts of the Golgi went all the way to the end and was sent back. That's the big picture. So let me ask if there are questions about that before we look at the fine points of how a ribosome attaches to the ER. Yeah?
When you have a membrane that's being modified either in the EMS or in the Golgi, is it modified on both sides?
Okay, what do you mean by a membrane being modified?
I mean a protein.
A protein being modified.
Is it modified?
Normally, when we talk about modified, we mean that there are enzymes inside the lumen which act on parts of the protein that stick into the lumen of the respective organelle. We're not talking about changes that occur to the cytoplasmic part. All right. So this is the big divide. For a ribosome making a protein, either it attaches to the ER or it doesn't. How do ribosomes making the appropriate proteins attach to the ER? The whole idea of how it works is called the signal hypothesis, and it's outlined on 7b. So we want to take a look at that. Now, the idea is this. You start out, you have a messenger RNA, the ribosomal subunits attach, the ribosome starts making a protein. So you have mRNA, you have ribosomes, you have tRNA, you have amino acids, etc., all that stuff we talked about last semester that you need for translation, and you get yourself, in step one, a ribosome with a growing chain, a partly made chain, which is called a nascent chain. Now, the ribosome doesn't know in advance what it's going to do. The ribosome doesn't know it's going to attach to the ER until it makes the appropriate protein. Now, I've written it here in these symbols that this is the amino end, because that's what's made first. Now, once you get this far, if there's no signal peptide, nothing happens. The ribosome just keeps chugging out the chain. The chain gets longer and longer as the ribosome moves down, and that protein will just be released in the cytoplasm. So, if there's no signal peptide,
you get the right-hand side of the big divide, and you just get the least protein. And the protein is just in the cytoplasm and, depending on the fine points, goes to one of the organelles or stays there. But what we're interested in is, what if this protein has a signal peptide? Now, in many cases, the signal peptide is right on the end. It's right near the amino end. And this is what says, take me to the ER. Now, in the original version of this hypothesis, people assumed that this sequence bound to the ER. But it turns out it doesn't. There's a bunch of middlemen involved here. And what has to happen is that this sequence, this special signal peptide, is recognized by the signal recognition particle, or the SRP. So that's the signal recognition particle. Now, I've written it here as a little triangle. And what is so significant about it is that it temporarily stops protein synthesis. So that means that we're not going to make any more protein. This whole complex is going to go to the ER. And that's going to give and attach to the appropriate structures on the ER so that when protein synthesis resumes, this protein will be traveling across the membrane into the ER. So we have a temporary pause to get our act together here. Now, notice I called it the signal recognition particle. That's because this is a large complex containing both protein and RNA. Now, we've already met some like this. A ribosome contains protein and RNA. A spliceosome contains protein and RNA. It turns out the cells have many of these large so-called machines containing both protein and RNA, many molecules of each, which carry out complex tasks. So this particular one, the signal recognition particle, contains both. And we have to have here what is called a signal sequence, or sometimes a signal peptide. Okay, so now in step three, this ribosome, messenger RNA, nascent protein is going to cozy up to the ER. So that's step three. So when we draw this here now for the ER, this is a bilayer. So what we're really saying is, if you compare it to the picture over here, we're looking at a piece of this. So this is a bilayer. There's another bilayer up here. This is the whole ER. But we're just looking at a little piece of the bilayer. So in that bilayer, there's a protein. And the SRP is going to stick to that protein, anchoring the ribosome, et cetera, at least temporarily, to the ER. So this protein, which matches the SRP, is called the SRP receptor, or the signal recognition particle receptor. This is the SRP receptor. Or, in a more colorful name, docking protein. Because the interaction of the SRP with its receptor docks, or at least temporarily locates the ship, so to speak, the ribosome et al. Next to the ER. Now, there are two components here, not one. In order for the protein to get into the ER, it has to cross the ER bilayer. In order to do that, you have to have a pore or some kind of channel-like structure in the ER membrane. And so that's the other thing we've written here. This channel is also known as the translocon. It's the special pore through which the growing protein will go as it grows. Now, some people talk about the translocon, meaning the whole complex here. And some people talk about the translocon, meaning only the pore part. And it should be clear from context which is meant, whether you mean the translocon complex or just the translocon. Now, so far, the translocon hasn't done anything. And in fact, you notice we've colored this part dark to imply that the channel is not open. The translocon is, in fact, gated so that things do not leak into the ER or out of the ER. Until the protein starts to move through, the channel is closed. Now, in the next step, we're going to have a handoff. In the next step, the SRP is going to fall off. The end of the new peptide is going to start wiggling through the translocon. So we're also going to have to open the translocon. So we're going to have to open the channel. We're going to recycle the SRP. It's going to be released, go find another new growing chain and start over. This whole operation requires energy, so we're going to split GTP. And we're also going to bind the ribosome to the ER. So all of that together is going to happen in the next step. We're not going into the details. If you're interested, you either take cell biology or read the book. But in step four then, what happens at the end of all this? We still have the message. We have the ribosome. But now the protein has started moving through the pore. So the receptor or docking protein has released what was bound to it. That's the signal recognition particle, which is going to go off and be used again. We've split the GTP. Now the one other thing, so we split the GTP, we recycled the SRP, we had to open the channel, but we still don't want things leaking in or out of the ER. And what takes care of that problem is that the ribosome is right up against the bottom. That's not clear from the picture, because I wanted the picture to be clearer. But the ribosome is right up against the bottom of the translocon. And that prevents things from leaking in and out. Small molecules can't leak in and out, but as the protein is made, it's going to be shoved through the channel. Now, in the original form of this hypothesis, people thought that you would just take the amino end and it would just wiggle through. But you notice I've drawn a loop here. And the reason for that is we think that's how it works. That the signal sequence or signal peptide sticks to the channel. And then as the chain grows, we just keep pushing the newly made chain. And that gives you the next picture, but I think it's more easily diagrammed. What we're saying here is you had a protein. This is its amino end. And when the protein was made, it had this special sequence, the signal sequence in it. And so as soon as a little bit was made, the signal recognition particle held on to it. And then the whole thing stuck to the outside of the ER, to the docking protein. But now the protein itself, the growing chain, has to go through the translocon. So the way it's thought to happen, well, this isn't there, but I can't do it otherwise, that you form a little loop like this, and the loop goes into the translocon. Okay. But now what happens? The ribosome originally is here, right? The ribosome makes more protein. The protein chain gets longer. So as it gets longer, it gets stuffed in. So the growing end of the chain gets longer and longer and longer. So as we make the chain, more and more protein is pushed through until by the time, if we finish the whole thing, all the chain, except, whoops, the chain, that wasn't supposed to happen, but this tape is a little too old. so we left a little, well, we have to leave a little bit behind. So there's a little bit of this little bit of signal peptide should be in, or signal sequence should be still locked in the membrane. And in fact, if you look at your picture now, you see this is step 5 is growing the chain, and step 6 is what happens by the time the chain is all the way across. Now there's one other feature that you see in step 6. That it's thought that this pore opens in 2 dimensions. The pore opens across the membrane, allowing the growing chain to go through. But the pore is also thought to open within the plane of the membrane. So when you get to the end, the protein's out there, but the signal sequence part would still be in the channel. But it's thought that the channel opens sideways. So if you think of the channel as being like this, normally we're talking about the protein going through. Here's our channel membrane. Here's our channel. The channel opens this way too. And if the channel opens this way, the protein, remember things can diffuse laterally in a membrane, the protein can slide out. And the signal peptide is usually somewhat hydrophobic. So the signal peptide can slide out into the membrane. And so you get the picture that you see there at the end of 6, where the translocon is finished and closed up again. The docking protein is just sitting there. And if this is the bilayer, here is our protein. It has slid out now of the translocon and is locked in the membrane. Now, usually what happens next is here is our protein. The signal sequence part is still in the membrane. The rest of the protein has entered the lumen. If this is going to be a soluble protein in the lumen, we have to detach the rest of the protein from the signal peptide. And this is usually what happens. There is an enzyme inside the lumen of the ER. And this enzyme is called signal peptidase. And its job is to cut off the signal peptide. So this enzyme is resident in the ER, and it recognizes a sequence here. Remember, this is the lumen of the ER. It recognizes a sequence in the protein, and it cuts it. Signal peptidase. So now the protein is free to fold up inside the ER, and the signal peptide usually gets degraded. And so that's how you make a protein which is soluble inside the lumen of the ER. And this can be passed to a vesicle, to the Golgi, to another vesicle, either to some part of the endomembrane system or outside the cell. Now, I now want to consider how you make a transmembrane protein. But before I do that, let me ask if there are questions about this process. And if not, you want to look at the other side of your handout, which shows you how you get a transmembrane protein. Now, the very top picture here is a repeat of exactly what we've been looking at. You have a bilayer. You have a ribosome with its amino end. But in order to make this picture clearer, we've left off the SRP, we've left off the translocon, we've left off the docking protein. All we have here is the bilayer and the newly made protein. And what we have drawn is exactly what is on the other side. That we'll draw a little bit of it again to make it clearer. That what we have here is that here is the bilayer, that the newly made protein inserts as a little loop,
And then as the chain grows, because we've left off the ribosome, the loop gets larger. And then as the ribosome, eventually it goes all the way through. And then signal peptidase cuts here somewhere,
cuts off the signal peptide, and you have a protein free in the lumen. Now, in a few cases, there is no sequence recognizable by signal peptidase. If the sequence recognized by signal peptidase is absent, what will happen? There will be no cut at this point. Therefore, the protein will become a transmembrane protein, and that's drawn over here on your handout. It will be anchored by its signal peptide in the membrane, and it will have a big domain in the lumen, but it won't have anything on the cytoplasmic side. And there are some proteins like that. Most transmembrane proteins, however, have both a domain in the cytoplasm and the domain in the lumen. One may be bigger than the other, as with the infamous emerin, but it has two domains. However, it works both ways. Some proteins, this is the membrane, some single-pass proteins have their carboxyl in the lumen and their amino in the cytoplasm, but some have it the other way around. Some single-pass proteins, in fact, I think more of them, have their amino on the outside and their carboxyl inside. Now, how is it possible to do either of these? They're both done by variations of the same routine. The trick to it is that there are hydrophobic sections in the protein that lock into the membrane so that as the protein is going through, it gets stuck. So let's see how that could work. So the first case that's shown on your handout shows how you get what is called a type 1 protein, which is a variant on this. Now, notice where is the amino end of this protein? If we cut it off here, well, maybe it's a variant of this, but it's not so obvious. So let's just see how it works. What if we were to do this, but not go all the way through? In other words, here's our protein, signal peptide on amino end. So we start the same way. You make a little bit of a loop, and this is the second line on your handout. You make a little bit of a loop with the signal peptide. Now what happens is the ribosome makes some peptide chain, and as it makes it, it's pushed through the pore. But now, in the middle of the protein, is a hydrophobic section. So when that hydrophobic section gets inside the translocon, when the translocon opens sideways, that hydrophobic section slides out into the membrane. Now, what does that give you? If you look at the second row there, so you have, here's your membrane, here's your bilayer, here's the signal peptide, here's the growing chain, here's the hydrophobic section, and then there's more protein made. But the point is that as this protein is made, it's not pushed through anymore because this little hydrophobic section gets stuck in the membrane. It used to be in a pore. Remember, it went into the translocon. But now it slides sideways out of the translocon. So once it's in the actual membrane itself, when you make more chain, you don't push anymore. So the protein, if we took off the channel, the protein would look like this. Its signal peptide is stuck in the membrane. This hydrophobic section in the middle is stuck in the membrane. But the rest of the protein is made in the cytoplasm because the ribosome can't push it through. Now, all we have to do is take signal peptidase and cut this part off, and what will we get? We get a transmembrane single-pass protein, and which end is where? This is the last part of the protein to be made, right? So which end is that? That's the carboxylin. This is the original amino end of the protein, but we cut off this little bit at the very end, and so the real amino end now is going to be inside the lumen. And of course we have signal peptide, which is lost. So in terms of our sponge model here, all we have to do is, once we get this far, we just have to cut off the signal peptide, and I just have to be careful to cut the right end, or it won't work. So I've abandoned my signal peptide in the membrane, and my hydrophobic section in the middle has anchored my protein, and I have a cytoplasmic domain with a carboxyl end, and a luminal domain with a amino end. Now, what you call this section that got stuck in the membrane? That has multiple names. It's usually sometimes called a stop transfer sequence. It's called an anchor sequence. It's called a topogenic sequence. Call all kinds of things. But it causes the protein to stop moving across and to get stuck, and it becomes the transmembrane domain of the protein. Now, how could you get it the other way around? How could you end up with a carboxyl on the outside, on the luminal side, and the amino left in the cytoplasm? That turns out to work if you have a slight variation. There's more than one way to do this, but one way to do it is consider a protein where the signal peptide is in the middle. So here's the amino end of the protein. Ribosome starts making protein, no signal peptide. So the ribosome chugs along, we make a nice long protein, no signal peptide, no signal recognition particle. But now when we get to the middle of the protein somewhere, there's a signal peptide. So now the signal recognition particle comes along, carries the ribosome and the message over to the ER, binds to the docking protein, and now we make a loop and start wiggling through. So how are we going to do that? Well, this is the growing part, right? So we start wiggling through here, and we just grow and grow and grow and grow. And by the time I'm finished, this part is stuck in the membrane. What used to be the signal peptide is now the transmembrane section, anchoring us in the membrane. What used to be the amino end still is the amino end, and it's in the cytoplasm. And the carboxyl end is now in the lumen. So by having an internal signal peptide, you can end up with a single pass protein that has its orientation reversed. And that's called a type 2, as shown on your handout. Now there's one other thing we have to mention. There are multipass proteins, right? A multipass protein, how does it get into the membrane? Doesn't wiggle in that way. What it does is to use the looping business. And that's what's shown on the last panel. And here would be a sample. If this is the signal peptide on the amino end in the usual place, we'd make a little loop and we'd start going through. Then when we got to here, what would happen? We'd get stuck. So now the ribosome would synthesize this part in the cytoplasm. But now we can have another hydrophobic section which starts a new loop. So it sticks into the same or another translocon, and we start another loop. And we either go all the way through, or if there's another hydrophobic section, the protein will get stuck. So depending on the number of hydrophobic sections, the number of these start and stop sequences, we will end up with some number of loops. And if, depending on whether the signal peptide is, we can either end up with the amino end on the outside or the amino end left in the cytoplasm. And depending on whether we have an odd or even number of starts and stops, we can end up with the carboxyl end all the way through on the luminal side or left on the cytoplasmic side. All of these variations are possible. Now, what do you call this sequence? This sequence here would be the signal peptide. This sequence would be a stop or an anchor sequence. But this sequence is a restart. So it's usually called a start sequence, even though it lodges in the membrane, because it restarts things going through. And then this one would be called a stop. Now, what's the difference between an internal start and an internal stop? And the answer is where it is. What order it comes in the line. If it comes after a stop, it's a start. If it comes after a start, it's a stop. These sequences are exactly equivalent. We know that because we can make recombinant proteins. And if we take these out or add these in, whatever, after a start, the next one in line becomes a stop, and after a stop, the next one in line becomes a start. So, by variations on this technology, on this procedure, you end up with proteins that are either single pass or multipass, and with their ends on either side of the membrane. Are there questions about this before we go on? Yeah.
Does the signal peptidase in type 2 not get degraded then, since it's the hydrophobic stop?
If a signal peptide is internal, it's not going to be degraded because it becomes the actual transmembrane protein, transmembrane domain. Yeah.
In these cases, is the ribosome always pressed under the translocon?
The ribosome is always under the translocon. As far as I know, yes. But if you're making this part of the protein, the ribosome is here, but the protein is coming out this way. Yeah?
So if there's ever a hydrophobic region due to the amino acids, it would stop there, correct?
Say that again?
Like in the amino acid sequence of the protein, if there's a hydrophobic...
If there is a hydrophobic section of the right length, it will, in fact, lodge in the membrane and become a transmembrane sequence. Is that what you mean? Yeah.
Didn't you mention that there's more than one ribosome on mRNA?
There is more than one ribosome on a messenger RNA. So probably what's really happening is there's one ribosome here under this translocon, and there's another ribosome here under the next translocon. And they're all doing it at once. Okay. Now, while we're talking about the endoplasmic reticulum, what else is going on in the endoplasmic reticulum? Once things get inside, what happens to them? So we've already mentioned one thing that happens inside the endoplasmic reticulum. Signal peptidase resides there. So if the signal peptide is going to get cut off, the enzyme that does that will do it inside the ER. Now, another thing that has to happen is folding. The protein has to fold up. Now, we know that the instructions for what shape to take are built into the amino acid sequence of the protein. But to reach that folded shape requires a set of proteins which are called chaperones or chaperonins. They help the protein to reach its lowest energy state. The actual consistent, we know that in a test tube, in dilute solution, proteins can fold properly by themselves. But a cell is actually quite crowded. And so these chaperones are needed to help the proteins fold properly and not bump into other things, get stuck, etc. And there are two major classes of chaperonins, one which are known as HP60 and HSP60 and HSP70. That refers to the 60 and 70 refers to the molecular weight of the protein when discovered, 60,000 versus 70,000. The HSP60 actually forms a barrel inside which the protein folds without bumping into anybody. And the HSP70 type sticks to hydrophobic regions, which normally are not supposed to be on the outside. and allows, protects them until the protein can fold properly. Now, why do chaperones have such a strange name? That's because the way they were discovered was people heated cells up and let them try and recover. And when cells are recovering from heat or other stress, they make a lot of proteins called originally heat shock proteins. And those turn out to be normal proteins used all the time to help new-made proteins fold. But when you mess up a cell, the cell makes extra copies to try and refold its damaged proteins. And so these were originally discovered as heat shock proteins. And there's a major one inside the ER, and it's a member of the HSP70, and it's called BIP. So this is the major one in the ER. Different parts of the cell have different chaperones. So mitochondria have one kind, the cytoplasm has one kind, and so forth, to allow proteins to fold appropriately. Now, once a protein is folded and its signal peptide is removed, if it's going to be, what else is going to happen to it? Well, if there are going to be disulfide bonds in the protein, they are formed inside the ER, although they too can form spontaneously under the right conditions. Under the conditions in a cell, there are enzymes that help the right SH groups orient and form disulfide bonds. And the enzymes that do that are all in the ER. Now that means that if a protein has SS bonds, it's either in the endomembrane system or it's outside the cell, if a domain has these. Proteins have cysteines or SH side groups everywhere. But for two SH side groups that come together and form a disulfide, that only happens inside the ER. Now, the one other thing we want to mention, and we keep talking about this glycosylation business and the addition of sugars. The addition of sugars happens entirely by enzymes inside the lumen of the ER and the Golgi. So only domains that are on the inside of the ER and the Golgi can be glycosylated. Glycosylation starts in the ER and finishes in the Golgi. It has two major parts that are called N and O glycosylation, respectively. In both of these, you end up adding short branch sugars. But the question is, where do they go? In the case of N-glycosylation, they're added to the side chain of asparagine. And in the case of O-glycosylation, they're added to the side chains of threonine and leucine, which have OH groups, while ASP has an amide side chain. So the N-glycosylation starts in the ER and gets finished up in the Golgi. And the O-glycosylation is 100% in the Golgi. Now, we've already said that some proteins stay in the ER, but we think that most proteins, even the ones that belong in the ER, go all the way to the end of the Golgi to get properly modified, and then they get sent back. Now, I want to say one other thing here about what happens in the ER. It's really about something that doesn't happen in the ER. Proteins are supposed to fold up properly, but a significant proportion of them don't manage to pull it off. They fold improperly, and they can usually be identified because they have hydrophobic regions exposed or some other abnormality. How do we get rid of them? It turns out that abnormally folded proteins are not degraded in lysosomes, but are degraded in a different part of the cell, in a structure or machine which is made of protein called a proteasome. This stands for protease, meaning degrading enzyme. In the proteasome also is sort of like a barrel. And the proteins, you know, like they say about the roach traps, you know, the roaches go in but they don't go out. So the proteins go in whole, and then they're broken to fragments. Not to amino acids, but to fragments inside. So the whole protein goes in, and fragments come out. Now, the proteasomes are located in the cytoplasm. So we understand that a misfolded protein in the cytoplasm gets sent to the recycling dump, or the bin. But what about a protein inside the ER that's misfolded? It is apparently sent back through the translocon to the cytoplasm and then to the proteasome. Now, there's only one piece of this that you have to know in addition. How is a protein marked? Send it to a proteasome. It turns out that a protein, in order to go to a proteasome, has to have a tag on it. And that tag is a very small protein called ubiquitin. This protein was discovered in many, many places. It was ubiquitous, so it was called ubiquitin. And it's quite small, and what happens is, using the appropriate enzymes, if you have a protein that's at it, you add a chain of ubiquitins to it. And that says, take me to a proteasome. Toodaloo. So this gets sent to a proteasome. The ubiquitins get cut off and reused. And the protein is degraded to fragments. Now, one of the most interesting side effects or aspects of all of this is that some of these fragments, in ways we'll explain maybe later in the class, are put back on the surface of the cell. They bind to proteins and end up on the surface of the cell. So that means that every one of your cells has on its surface little pieces of whatever you're making. And this is how the immune system knows what's going on inside your cells. And if you're making viral proteins, there's little bits of viral protein on the outside of the cell, and that cell is doomed, we hope. So that's how your cells know, and we'll get back to that. We have a few little details here about the ER, and then we will talk about the Golgi and the other parts of the cell. If you have your extra credit assignment, you can put it in the big box. If you have your schedule for the late exam, you can put it in the small box.